Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Before we hop into this episode with David, which you're not going to want to miss, I just want to talk about upgrading your kitchen. And we found some incredible products that we're so excited to share with you that are really going to help to add natural, good, clean ingredients in your kitchen. Because guess what? We can't always control what we're eating out or how we're feeling, but we can control what we have within our own kitchen. Now, these are Ava Jane's products, and they have things like Colima sea salt, avocado oil, sweetened cacao, spices. So many incredible things that are really going to be staples within your kitchen, right? And finding ingredients and products that you can actually trust, which we trust these. We love it. And here's the thing, your regular table salt just isn't cutting it. And it could be the thing that's adding to a little bit more inflammation and, you know, kind of holding onto those excessive fluids that we really want to continue to pump out of our body. Now, when you switch to something like a Colima sea salt, what's great about them is that it is a coarse, crunchy, moist sea salt. It's unrefined, ocean-borne, microplastics free, all natural, and is packed with trace minerals that your body really needs to continue to fuel and feel its best. It's harvested by hand just 16 weeks each year, and it actually tastes good beyond just being good for you. So if you want to grab a free bag of this sea salt and really try it out and see what it can feel like within your own body and in your own kitchen, then just go to optimalsalt.com. They're giving you a free bag. All you have to do is pay shipping. So optimalsalt.com. I'll also have that linked up in the show notes. Check it out. Grab your bag. Maybe check out their avocado oil or their cacao, anything else that you might be interested in as well. These are products you can trust. We are trusting, and we're bringing it to you so that now you can upgrade your kitchen supplies. This next interview is super cool because this guy is so fascinating, really smart. A lot of great information is going to be shared in this podcast, so you're going to want to tune in, take notes, and share this out. Now, Dr. David Rabin is an MD, PhD, a neuroscientist, board-certified psychiatrist, a health tech entrepreneur, and the inventor who has been studying the impact of chronic stress in humans for more than a decade. He is the co-founder and chief innovation officer at Apollo Neuroscience, which has developed the first scientifically validated wearable technology that actively improves energy, focus, relaxation, using a novel touch therapy that signals safety to the brain. He's always been fascinated by consciousness and our inherent ability to heal ourselves from injury and illness. And as such, he has specifically focused his research on the clinical translation of non-invasive therapies for patients with treatment-resistant illnesses like PTSD and substance use disorders. He's the co-founder and executive director of the Board of Medicine, a 501c3 nonprofit organization of physicians and scientists establishing the first peer-reviewed evidence-based clinical guidelines for the production and safe use of currently unregulated alternative medicines, including plant medicines. So not only does he have this and his clinical psychiatry practice, but he's also conducting research on the epigenetic regulation of trauma responses and recovery to elucidate the mechanism of psychiatric assisted psychotherapy and the neurobiology of belief. Dr. Rabin really is an incredible human doing so much to help and give back. And beyond that, he's been married to his co-founder, Catherine, since 2016. Such an incredible human doing incredible work. So I hope that you really enjoy this episode.
Dr. Rabin, thanks so much for coming in and spending some time with us to talk stress. I know you've done so much work in this field, both on the study of and looking into solutions for different stress-related disorders. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
First of all, I think understanding, you know, what chronic stress is and how it impacts our body would be really helpful. I think we all experience this, especially time to time, more often than not, I would say, in this world. So understanding how we recognize it, what it's doing, and what we can start to do for it would be really helpful. Not all in that order. We could just unpack it slowly.
Sure. I think that's a great place to start. So I think the, you know, as you alluded to, I think, you know, we all experience chronic stress in one way or another because our bodies evolved to manage stress in the environment because of survival, right? So when the main survival part, things that happen around us that trigger our bodies into a stress response, which is what we think of as the fight or flight response, is supposed to be things like lack of food, lack of air, lack of water, lack of shelter, lack of acceptance by our community, and, you know, immediate danger, like a predator chasing us or an immediate threat to our livelihood. And those stressors are meant to, not just in humans, but in almost all animals that we know of, particularly mammals, which means that the stress response is hundreds of millions of years old, is that it triggers a response that diverts resources away from the parts of our bodies that are responsible for reproduction, digestion, immunity, creativity, empathy, connecting with others, sleep, etc., all the things that make our lives good and help us to thrive and feel healthy. And it takes those resources in times of survival threat, like lack of food, lack of water, lack of air, predators, etc., and diverts all those resources to our skeletal muscles, our heart, our lungs, and our motor cortex of our brain and our fear center of our brain to make sure that we can fight, flight, or freeze, right? To get out of the threatening situation that we're in and then go to a safety situation. And that safe situation is then what allows us to recognizing that safe situation where we're away from the threat, allows us to re-divert resources back to the recovery nervous system, which is called the parasympathetic system. So that's the part of the nervous system that governs and diverts resources to reproduction, recovery, sleep, immunity, et cetera. And we want that to happen in the short term, right? In the acute, immediate moment when we are exposed to a survival threat, we want that redirection of resources to happen because we don't want to be thinking about digestion or reproduction when we're trying to run from a lion. That would put us in jeopardy of not escaping the lion, right? And then what's the point of digesting your food if you're not alive anymore? So the body in all mammals has evolved over millions and millions of years to have this very, very hardwired response. The challenge now that we all face in modern life is that our bodies don't know the difference between a survival threat that is an actual survival threat, like what I just described, and a perceived survival threat. So that would be something like too many emails, too much noise around us, too much construction sounds, too many kids screaming, too many responsibilities, too much news, right? All of these things trigger our brains and our bodies to feel like it's under threat, even though we're actually just overwhelmed. And so that takes those precious resources we need to recover and sends them to our stress response, fight or flight system, the sympathetic nervous system, even though we're not under survival threat, which then takes resources away from our recovery system on the long term, which then deprives all of our recovery nervous system, like our reproductive system, our digestive system, immunity, et cetera, from the precious resources it needs for us to feel good and to be healthy. And so it's managing that chronic stress response and making sure we remind ourselves of when we're actually under threat or when we're actually not under threat because we're just in traffic or we're just overstimulated to allow ourselves to rebalance our nervous systems, which is what all of the safety techniques do, like deep breathing, yoga, mindfulness, meditation, soothing touch, soothing music, etc.
I want to take a quick pause from this discussion on stress with Dr. Rabin and talk about something that I think is one of the most important things to keep our body balance, to help with our stress, and it's something that none of us pay a close enough attention to, and that is hydration. One of the things that Jen and I have started doing consistently, it has become a staple in our kitchen and our daily routine, is using Element. That's L-M-N-T, which is a daily electrolyte mix that adds incredible flavor into your water, but also adds the needed sodium, potassium, and magnesium that we sweat out every day, even when we're not realizing it. Even when we're just going on a daily walk, we lose so many of these electrolytes. And not having balanced electrolytes can result in things like brain fog, fatigue, different mental disturbances, disturbances in our sleep, so many things that rely on having good balanced electrolytes in our system can be resolved by drinking Element on a daily basis. And like I said, it tastes incredible. They have so many great flavors. So if you're interested, just go check the link out in the show notes. It's just drinklmnt.com/optimal, and you get a free sample pack with every order. Any order that you make, you get a free sample pack so that you can keep trying different flavors and find your favorites. They're not just for water. You can also add them into smoothies. You can use them to make seasonings for different wings. I made an incredible mango chili wing that was absolutely delicious to eat when I watched football on Sundays. So go try it out. Get the link in the show note. Get yourself some Element and balance your electrolytes today. All right, let's get back into the discussion on stress.
Does that kind of make sense?
That was brilliant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that lays a really cool foundation for us to kind of branch off into some different questions. And I love how you started right away with this foundational and evolutionary component of our nervous system being the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, and how it's interesting to me how now our brain equates what used to be running away from this lion, which not many people do in the modern world these days, to having too many emails in our inbox. And it's just interesting to me, like, how did our nervous system and minds make that transition to start to perceive these things that aren't an immediate threat to our lives and our livelihood, like emails or traffic or something like that, as something that should flip us into this sympathetic or fight and flight system? And what can people do to start to retrain that, to be in traffic and start to say, hey, this, I'm not going to die. This is not something that should put me this much on edge. How can somebody consciously start to train themselves to stay in more of that parasympathetic, restful space?
Yeah, that's also a great question. And I think that maybe the other way of thinking about it is not just why we've been trained to react to non-survival threat, like too many emails, in the way that we react to a lion in the jungle, but also, you know, that perhaps it's also because we have not been trained effectively to reappraise threat, because our nervous systems, or to reevaluate it, right? Our nervous systems are hardwired, as I was saying earlier, to respond to threat, whether it's real threat or perceived threat, in the same way. So our bodies are just doing what our bodies know how to do because we're overstimulated. And because we thinking about uncertainty itself, right? If you think want to think about it this way, uncertainty itself can be perceived as threat when we are not prepared for it. And so what that means is that when we are have so much going on in our lives, and you know, we have so many things happening, and we haven't learned one of the core techniques of self-regulation or balancing our mind and body, which is attention control, which is typically taught in ancient Eastern and tribal traditions through breathing techniques, then what happens is we start getting all this incoming information, right? From the environment, again, noise, traffic, overwhelming responsibilities, funny looks from people, etc. And without learning how to control our attention to what's coming in and to recognize, you know, what's coming in and what we pay attention to as what's coming in is actually what enters into our consciousness and what becomes part of us, then ultimately we start paying attention to whatever it is that's capturing our attention rather than what actually deserves our attention. Mm-hmm. And so things like thinking about how I'm going to be late for work and this is could be the, you know, this could be like the end of my life and I'm going to have such a horrible day and all these things. Well, yeah, you might be late for work because there's traffic, but is it the end of your life because you're late for work? Well, probably not, right? You'll probably figure it out. So while our, you know, brains might consider that we might be late for work and that might have a lot of consequences like being reprimanded or being disciplined or having other issues with our boss or confrontations or et cetera, you know, ultimately it's not the end of our lives. It's not actually going to dramatically impact our survival. And the most important thing is that we get to work safely and we don't cause a car accident, which could actually impact our survival.
So
when we think about it in that way, it's really just restoring our attention control to what actually matters in the moment. And the best way to do that, that I mentioned a little bit earlier, is just breathing. Because breathing, intentional breathing, where we actually take our attention and redirect it to our breathing, is what restores our sense of control over how we feel in the moment. It reminds us to be present by centering our mind in our bodies. And ultimately, our anxiety is directly related to, and I wish this is something they taught us when we were much younger, but because it's very simple overall, but our anxiety is related to how in control we feel in any given moment. The more time we spend thinking about things or paying attention to things that we don't have control over, like future things or past things, then the more likely we are to feel out of control of our situation. And therefore, the more our anxiety goes up that much of the time. On the contrary, if we spend more time thinking about things we do have control over, like our breath, our movement, what we put into our bodies, etc., then we actually feel more in control more of the time. And this is the practice of what the fundamental practice of mindfulness is all about. And so if we, and breath work. And so if we focus on redirecting our attention to our breath or to what we have control over in any moment, rather than thinking about what we don't have control over, then we start to feel more in control more of the time, and our anxiety comes down dramatically, and therefore our body stress comes down dramatically, and then we redirect our resources back to the recovery system.
I mean, you are talking me and Dom's language right now. We talk about breath work. I mean, it feels like at exhaustion because we're trying to help get this message, especially when we're talking about pain. And we practice it in so many situations. I mean, going into a cold plunge, we have that at our home now. So being able to, you know, connect to the breath is so incredibly powerful. But when you're talking about intentional breathing, can you, like, what is the research around the type of breathing that really connects us back to reduce that stress? Is there a pattern that we could be mindful of? What is there a way that we breathe, whether it's like in one nostril, out the other, or is it, you know, what are the types of breathing that the research is really saying can really help with this chronic stress?
So there's as many types of breathing techniques probably as there are humans on the earth. breathing is a very personal thing, but there are a lot of research has been done, particularly from the biofeedback world, which is the study of what changes in the body as we breathe, and about the way that the body gets into optimal states of calm or balancing of the what we call the autonomic nervous system, which is the part of our nervous system that is the parasympathetic recovery system and then the sympathetic fight or flight system. All both make up the autonomic nervous system that's running in the background to regulate our heart, our lungs, and every organ system in our bodies, and to redirect resources in the way we've been talking about. So the biofeedback research over the last 30 or 40 years, interestingly, has shown that what the Eastern medicine practitioners have known for thousands of years, which is that the best form of breathing for most people to start at is somewhere between 5 to 7 breaths per minute. And the easiest way to do that, which can be through your mouth or through your nose, I think in general, nose breathing is better. And it's better to have your exhales be slightly longer than your inhale. So it could be like 5 seconds inhale, 6 seconds exhale, as simple as that. And then over time, as you practice this breathing technique, and it doesn't have to be exactly 5 and 6. It could be 5 and 6 or 6 and 7 or something like that. But just as a general rule, having your exhales slightly longer than your inhales and trying to do it through your nose. If you can't do it through your nose, then you could do it through pursed lips. Like if you imagine breathing through a straw where you're controlling the airflow with your lips. And then that helps you to understand how you can actually control airflow by changing the aperture of your lips or how tight or open your lips are, which is similar to whistling, or for some people who can't whistle or have never drunk out of a straw, it's similar to smoking in terms of the way your lips are pursed, but it's basically using your lips to control the airflow. And then as you learn to control the airflow, then doing these 5 to 7 breaths per minute, actually very quickly within somewhere between 90 and 120 seconds for 95% of people in the biofeedback research, radically calms down the nervous system, reduces heart rate, reduces breath rate, and helps people, and reduces blood pressure, and helps people just feel more mentally at ease. And even in studies of mental illness like depression and PTSD, we see that people doing this technique in, you know, 5 to 10 minutes actually report a substantial reduction in anxiety in their symptoms, which is really interesting. So it's doing something that simple that can really change the outcome of a situation you're in. And you can, the nice part about breathing is it's free and you can do it anytime.
I love that.
No, I think that's great. And I think that, again, the power and empowerment that comes with that, because especially when people start learning about the autonomic nervous system, or, you know, even early on in our graduate studies, you learn about this autonomic nervous system as just the thing that automatically responds to your environment and does whatever, you know, it needs to do in that moment. And I think the initial thought is that we don't have a lot of control over that. But as you just brought up, you know, yes, it responds automatically, but it can also respond to things that we voluntarily do, like change our breath. And I think as soon as people feel that first flip, I call it the little parasympathetic flip that you get from changing your breath, like you said, even within 90 seconds or 5 or 10 minutes of doing this, that gives people so much power, because immediately they're like, wow, I've never felt this tool or this ability to change my anxiety levels in such a short amount of time. I guess my question would be, how long does somebody need to practice this? Is there some sort of training effect where if you do it consistently, it will just overall bring down general anxiety levels throughout the day? Or is it something that needs to be kind of practiced consistently on a day-to-day basis?
So in general, it does need to be practiced, because like everything we do, we get better at the things we practice. So
absolutely,
if you think about, and you know, Eric Kandel's research from 2000 or 2000 and the 50 years before that won him the Nobel Prize in 2000 was all about this learning, and how we learn by practice. So ultimately, if we practice being stressed and responding to environmental signals that are not actual threats with a threat response, then what happens is our bodies become tuned to respond in this way, and therefore we become practiced, and that's what builds habit. And just because it's practice and it's habit and our bodies are responding to stress in that way doesn't mean that habit is serving us, which is what most of us find ourselves in our day-to-day lives, is responding to things as threat, even though they're not, by accident. Even the best of us, the most practiced of us, have these kinds of situations arise. And so ultimately, this is like a practice makes mastery situation, right? So as you were saying, you know, being able to feel what it feels like to enter a state of calm, safety, peaceful mind, quiet mind in a situation that might have otherwise been stressful or alarming to you in the past, can be a dramatically empowering feeling for an individual. So the first time you experience it, that's the opportunity to remember that feeling and to think about that feeling. And then you can use that feeling as your guide to aim for whenever you're in any other situation where you want to calm yourself down or settle yourself or regain control of your attention and decision-making power in any moment. And so the more that you practice this kind of activity, the better you get at it. And it's not limited to breathing. It's breathing. It's all vagal or parasympathetic action. Any activity that induces a vagal or parasympathetic response will nudge the body into these states of empowered control, as you're talking about. So breath work is one way. Breath work is one of the most fundamental ways, which is very, very much also, you know, evolved for a long period of time. Our body does breathe in the background, as you mentioned also, but that breathing in the background is only when it's influenced by the environment. And so if we decide to take control of our breathing by putting thought into it or attention on it, then we restore control over how our bodies are reacting to the environment. which is how we minimize the stress that's induced by the environment, or at least put it, keep it in check. So the other techniques that do this are soothing touch, soothing music, again, movement, yoga, movement meditation. Yoga is like a movement meditation. And there's many, and biofeedback, and there's many, many other techniques. Mindfulness and meditation are kind of a take on breath work in a different perspective of observing more than just breath, but what's going on in the environment. And so we're able to, by practicing not just one of these techniques, but ideally all of these techniques as often as we can, then what we're doing by practicing these techniques is we're reminding our bodies, despite what our bodies might be taking in from the environment, we're reminding our bodies that we are safe and that we are in control. And that if we have the ability to pay attention to the feeling of our breath coming into our nose, mouth, and lungs right now, or the feeling of this soothing touch on my body, or the feeling of Apollo vibrating on my body in the case of, you know, the wearable touch, then we can't be running from a lion in this moment. And so our bodies naturally start to self-regulate by remembering safety. Mm. And so it's this constant training and practice and remembering that if what is does what's called reconditions our nervous system to respond the way we want it to, so that we are able to recover as quickly and as much as we possibly can in any situation that's safe. And then when we're in a situation that's not safe, we are ready to respond quickly and get out of that situation as quickly as possible to safety so that we can restart the recovery process.
I mean, huge. And all those different techniques that you brought up is like, that's everything that's going to be my biggest test in labor in a few months. But everything that they discuss, you know, focusing on the breath, getting into dim lighting, getting into a music that you like to have around you. And I will say that is going to be my ultimate test when it comes to this. But it's so empowering, you know, knowing that we have that ability to take that on and to put that into our bodies and try as best as we can to flip the environment of what we're perceiving as stress. Now, you also touched on heart rate variability. Can you dive into what exactly that is and how that impacts our bodies and our stress as well?
Sure. So heart rate variability is a measure of resilience in the body, or a measure of how much our bodies have recovered and are able to bounce back from stress. And there's lots of different measures of heart rate variability. You know, a lot of wearables track it these days. Some of them do it more accurately than others. But I think the main point about heart rate variability is that it's a measure of how recovered our bodies are by looking at how the heartbeat changes over time. And it so happens that from these really interesting studies of biofeedback and the cardiovascular health literature, that heart rate variability, which is the rate of change of our heartbeat over time. So every beat, we think about our heartbeat as 60 beats. If it's 60 beats per minute, as an example, that we think about it like every beat is exactly 1 second apart, but that's actually not the case. Our heartbeat changes. The amount of time between each beat changes every cycle of breath. So HRV, or heart rate variability, is a measure of how recovered our bodies are, because it's a measurement of the rate of change of our heartbeat over time. So what that means is that most people think that when you say you have a 60 beat per minute heartbeat, that every beat is exactly 1 second apart. But that's not actually the case. What actually is happening is every time you breathe, every time you move, every time you think about something calming versus something stressful, the time between each beat changes. And so sometimes it's half a second apart, and sometimes it's 1.5 seconds apart. And the more variability between each beat, the higher our HRV. And it just so happens, from the biofeedback literature over the last 30 or 40 years and the cardiovascular health literature, that we've seen that the higher the heart rate variability, the lower the resting heart rate, generally speaking. And as we know from cardiovascular health, the lower our resting heart rate, the more cardiovascularly fit we are, the less likely we are to become, you know, have a heart disease or a heart attack episode or something like that. Obviously, we don't want it to go too low, but we're talking about
if you're very physically fit, you know, your resting heart rate goal should be somewhere around in the low 40s when you're sleeping or when you first wake up in the morning. And low 40s would mean that your HRV goal would be somewhere ideally in the 60s and above. And it doesn't, everybody has their own personal heart rate variability that they start out at when you first start measuring it. The individual numbers themselves are not that important, except for the fact that over time we want them to trend up. So, you know, the wearables like the Apple Watch, the Oura Ring, some of the Fitbits and the Garmins, et cetera, that track HRV can be interesting, but people get caught up in the daily numbers, and the daily numbers aren't that useful because everything impacts HRV, like movement. And so if you are not aware of how to track your HRV, then the numbers can throw you off. The real way, most accurate way to track it is in the lab with an EKG machine, and most people don't have those at home. So when you're at home and you're measuring it at home, the best way to do it is to think about it on a weekly basis or a monthly basis and try to get your average HRV to trend up week over week. If you notice one week that your HRV is really low, meaning lower than your normal, or in even as low as in the less than 30 range, that means you're probably underslept and not recovered well, which means you probably don't want to push yourself very hard because you're not going to respond or cope with stress as well. And you're probably going to be more irritable, more likely to make mistakes in whatever it is you're doing. And so that's why HRV is important, but it's not causal. It doesn't, having low HRV doesn't mean you will get sick. It means that your body is not recovered. So it's a measurement tool of just how recovered we are at any moment.
Yeah, I think that these biofeedback devices, and I mean, heart rate variability is something that has come on really strong, especially in like the last decade, and how these companies like Oura, which I'm wearing an Oura ring right now, are incorporating that to help people better understand like how to use that data in order to make more informed decisions on a day-to-day basis, depending on what our system physiologically is prepped to be able to recover from it on any given day. And I think, again, you keep kind of bringing up this biofeedback and how that can be so valuable in teaching us about how we can recover from stress or what have you. And also, you've mentioned touch a few times and how touch can be very healing for our system. You briefly mentioned the wearable device that you were the co-founder of, which is Apollo Neuro, I believe, and it's one of the, or is the first scientifically studied and proven device to be able to clinically lower some of those stress markers that you measure. So can you talk, one, about healing touch, and then also about how a device like Apollo Neuro is able to really tap into that healing touch for our stress levels?
Sure thing. So touch is really interesting because, well, for two main reasons. So the first reason is because, like breath, touch has been around as a soothing input to us from our loved ones since the earliest mammals, the oldest monkeys, the oldest animals, they all that are mammals that breastfeed their young, they all hold each other to calm each other down and remind each other that they're safe. So this is, again, tens, if not hundreds of millions of years old, as a safety signal to the body that you're safe, you can recover, you can calm down, you don't have to be in a stress response right now. And breathing, intentional breathing, when you put your attention on your breathing, it's the same, engaging the same pathway of calming the body and reminding ourselves that we're in control of the situation. And so so this is really, really important to understand, because what these old techniques do, these ancient neurobiological techniques that we've evolved do, is they're hardwired into our brains from our bodies to regulate the safety response. Safety triggers the parasympathetic recovery nervous system to divert resources back to reproduction, digestion, immunity, sleep, all of the stuff that makes our lives good that we don't want getting resources when we're running from a lion. So if we're not running from a lion because we're noticing the feeling of the soothing of the breath coming into our nose, mouth, and lungs, or because of the soothing touch of a loved one or ourselves, or because of, or a pet, or because of the vibrations from Apollo, which are, imitating or replicating some of the benefits of soothing touch through sound waves, then we can effectively remind our brains that we are not under threat, because our brains evolved to not allow us to pay attention to soothing sensation when we're actually running from the lion, right? Mm-hmm. So that hardwired pathway is really important to understand. Our brains will not allow us to override the fear sensation of an actual threat like a lion outside our den, which is why we can't sleep when we're stressed out, right? Mm-hmm. Sleep is our most vulnerable state of being. So if we're physically subdued, our protective mechanisms physically are offline to allow us to sleep deeply. So our brains and our bodies will not allow us to sleep deeply if we perceive that any threat is around the corner, which is why many of us can't sleep right now, because we're overstimulated. I think it's like 9 out of 10 Americans are struggling to fall asleep right now, which is horrible. And that impacts all the rest of our health. So doing things like soothing touch is really interesting, because it's what we call a bottom-up technique. It's where you make the body feel a certain way, and then without the brain having to do anything, and then the body calms down because it's receiving the soothing stimulation of the touch, and then our minds follow suit and calm down because it recognizes the touch is safe. Mm-hmm. So what we figured out in the lab at the University of Pittsburgh is, by studying these touch responses in the body, we learned that these are hardwired. And this is well known. This wasn't something that we figured out. This is something that we just learned from the literature of others that have studied this for decades. And when we figured that out from what other people had done, we said, okay, well, if this is hardwired and the body is hardwired to respond in this way to threat and this way to things like touch or to soothing music, like when you get out of work and you get into your car and you turn on the radio and your favorite song comes on, you forget about the crappy day you had just instantaneously, that is a hardwired safety response. So we asked the question of, well, how, for people who haven't learned how to focus on their breath because they're so stressed out that they don't even know how to control their attention anymore, they've forgotten how to do it, can we calm the body to remind the brain that it's safe so that it can restore control over its attention? So it's called experiential learning, or bottom-up learning, which is also one of the things that Eric Kandel won the Nobel Prize for. So can we tap into that using technology? And after many years of studying touch, we figured out that you actually could do this in a couple different ways. And we then developed Apollo based on the neuroscience of touch to effectively deliver songs, music specifically composed for your touch receptors of your skin to your skin anywhere in your body that helps calm the body and then clear your mind.
Wow. So what does this device, I think you have it on. Is that correct? Which people on the podcast can't unfortunately see. To explain for other people who can't see, what does it look like? How does it work? And what is it doing to create that touch response?
So it's using, as I mentioned earlier, it is music, but it's music that's composed specifically for our skin instead of our ears. Our ears receive music like we hear all the time, day to day. That's high frequency sound waves. So this is low frequency sound waves that would come out of a subwoofer, that come out of Apollo, that you feel in your skin and in your bones. Mm. And it conducts through the touch receptors of your skin instead of your ears, and through the touch receptors that go as deep as our bones, that then conduct that frequency, that rhythm, all the way up to your brain, that says, like somebody holding your hand on a bad day or giving you a hug, that you're safe right now. And so that is effectively how it works. It's a wearable device. It's about the size of a Apple Watch or Fitbit. It can be worn on the wrist, ankle, or arm, or with a clip. You can clip it onto your clothing, like I do now with my shirt, or you can clip it onto your to your belt or your bra. And it is effectively giving the benefits of deep breathing to people who have never learned how to do it. I was one of those people personally. And it was very challenging for me to learn how to deep breathe. And I'm still struggling with it on a regular basis because I forget, because I didn't learn it as a kid, like most of us. And so I think the challenge is real, you know, in terms of how to learn to control our attention more effectively. So when we developed this technology, we were thinking about it from the standpoint of our patients with PTSD and depression. We were trying to retrain to do deep breathing, but doing deep intentional breathing when you're already so stressed out with symptoms of mental illness is like a failing mission, right? You're like asking people to try to gain control of their attention when they're already constantly overwhelmed. And that's just adding another responsibility to them, which makes them more stressed out half the time. So, you know, we were basically asking the question then, why are we setting these people up for failure? Why don't we try to figure out a better way to calm them down that they're in control of, like a device like this, where they can turn it on whenever they want and restore a sense of control and empowerment to their bodies through safety when they don't have somebody else around? Why don't we give them something like that that requires almost no effort if it's possible, and then teach them breathwork with that technology, or teach them breathwork after? And so the way we developed Apollo was we figured out how to first deliver the safety responses through touch, through these sound waves to the skin. And then once we got that right, then we figured out that if we changed those sound waves in very specific ways, that we could remind the body to breathe. Mm-hmm. And so the rhythms that Apollo is delivering to the body are actually the rhythms that we all want to get into to optimize our breath, which is what I mentioned earlier, that 5 to 7 breaths per minute. And when we tested that in the lab at the University of Pittsburgh in a number of different trials, we found out that very clearly this is doing just that. And it reminds people to breathe, but it also reminds people that they're safe, and then their physical performance goes up, which just came out in a recent study. And their cognitive performance goes up, and their feelings of stress come down, and their heart rate comes down, their HRV goes up, and they feel better and they perform better. So all of those same things that you get with brief breath work and with meditation, mindfulness, and yoga, you can actually get by just touching yourself or using something that helps you touch yourself in a safe way on the go, which is really interesting. And I think it's an exciting time for science, because this is the first technology that does this, but I'm sure there will be many more to come.
Wow, that's huge.
That's incredible. And I just have to say, for a second, that I freaking love neuroscience, because it's so cool when you can put something on your body like that, that delivers the frequency. And I would love to nerd out all day. I'm sure it would bore people to death who are listening about, you know, the nitty gritty of the receptors that we're targeting, because I know there are certain receptors in the body that respond to vibration and things like that. But like you said, it's this thing that happens to the body first, body calms down, then the brain responds, so that we automatically shift all of these processes without consciously thinking about anything. We start to breathe a little bit slower. We start to take longer breaths. It increases heart rate variability. Our immunity is going up. Our ability to think more clearly is going up. And it's all something, again, that we're not necessarily voluntarily doing. We're putting this thing on our body that's delivering the stimulus, which I think is so cool. You mentioned slightly different frequencies that you might use. Are there different frequencies that people would use for different reasons?
Yeah. So similar to music, you know, we have 7 different songs for the skin, basically, that are different work the same for most people from our clinical trials. I think that we've seen, you know, the general 7 experiences that people tend to want to have during any given day are range from being wide awake when you're feeling exhausted to being sleepy being able to fall asleep more easily. And these really center around the core transitions that we experience in any day, right? So if you think about what are the most stressful times that we have in our day-to-day lives, it's state change. It's going from sleepiness to wakefulness, wakefulness to sleepiness, work to meditation, work to being social, social to hanging out with our families and kids, right? And those transitions are the times where we have to change our level of energy and change our level of attention and our focus of what we're doing and how we're interacting with people around us. All of those state changes are stressful to our bodies, even though we may not realize it. And so what we thought about was, you know, how do we create something that just smooths out those transitions for people and sort of meets them in one state and makes it easier to get into another state, which is the way people use music. And our research team originally were all musicians, myself included, and really noticed profoundly the impact that music had on our own lives. And so we thought, well, what if we put out a bunch of samples for people of these vibrations and see how they respond blindly? And we did. And people responded fairly similarly. And then we tested that in the real world in thousands of people, and people responded fairly similarly to certain ones and told us what they thought. And it was relatively consistent responses. And then we brought that down into 7 modes or vibes that are currently available in the Apollo app. So these are energy and wake up, which is kind of like an espresso shot, social and open, which is a creative social flow state, clear and focused, which, and I'm going from most energetic to least energetic here. So clear and focused is kind of like amphetamines. It's like an intense, sustained, deep focus on one thing, which is what we're testing for ADHD right now in kids and adults. Then the most balanced, even mode is the rebuild and recover mode, which is what people use after workouts. We've shown it reduces heart rate much more quickly after intense physical stress, and also helps people calm down after any emotional or mental stressor. People use it a lot for travel, after giving talks and after other stressful events. And then we get in, and that's the most even of all of the modes. It's not wakeful nor sleepy. It's just even and calm. And then down from there, we have the most calming modes, which are the meditation mindfulness, which is as it says, but it's also really helpful for aches and pains and helpful for kind of just having a just sort of more chill, calm, but not quite sleepy energy state. Then below that is relax and unwind, which is kind of, people think of it almost like a glass of whiskey. It's like a very intense relaxing wind down that people use right before bed. And then the sleep and renew, which is what people use in bed. And what's really, really interesting about this is you asked the question about practice before. Well, practicing techniques that require attention can be very challenging when we're stressed because we forget. But what's interesting about Apollo is it doesn't really require any attention. You just have to turn it on or schedule it to turn on, and it'll turn on by itself. And if we did a study with our users who have Aura rings, and what we found out was that in, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 people who have Aura rings and use Apollo, that when you compare their post-Apollo data to their pre-Apollo Aura ring data, what we've seen is that not only does it Apollo use help in the short term, but it actually helps cumulatively in the long term, just like exercise or meditation or yoga. So if you use Apollo, it looks like the sweet spot is about 3.5 hours a day, using it some at night, 1.5 to 2 hours at night, and 1.5 to 2 hours during the day, and 5 or more days a week, that we see that people are getting, on average in these groups, 18, 19% increase in deep sleep, 14% increase in REM, 4% decrease in resting heart rate, and 11% increase in HRV. So what those numbers over 3 months. So what those numbers equate to is, number one, consistency of use is really important, just like exercise, just like deep breathing, just like yoga. You got to keep doing it to retrain your nervous system and your body. But just like exercise and yoga and deep breathing and mindfulness techniques, if you use Apollo consistently and provide the soothing touch feedback to your body, you're boosting your parasympathetic vagal tone in your nervous system enough that you can actually get similar benefits that we see in studies with meditation, yoga, and these other mindfulness techniques. So you're getting a comparable response just by wearing something that's targeting your nervous system in a similar way through touch. So it doesn't really matter how you get there, how you get to the recovery state and the safety state, but the more things you do to get to that safety state and keep yourself there, reminding yourself that you're safe, then the bigger your responses are over time. And then the more resilient your body is, the more your HRV goes up, the better you feel on a regular basis, and the closer you are to reaching your full potential, which the exciting part is potentially unknown, right? I think this is showing us that our potential as human beings is potentially much, much greater than we ever thought, and that we actually have the ability to test it in ourselves as our own laboratory experiments safely using wearable technology and all these techniques we've been talking about.
This is absolutely so huge. I mean, because we live in such a state of, like you said, constant stimulation. I mean, the thing that went up, I think, from after COVID, not only general stress, but everyone started watching TV a lot more. You start binging things. So you're constantly stimulated from work to life, to everything. And so being able to have something on that can even just automatically turn on, is that what you said, from the app? You can set different settings. That's That's absolutely incredible and can really help to start to change the way that people are feeling within their bodies, which is everything that we try to do as physical therapists is start to create that change, especially when so many people are dealing with chronic pain. You know, it's not just chronic stress, but it's chronic pain as well. And it's translating into what they're feeling physically. So, I mean, David, this is just absolutely incredible. I love the work that you're doing because it's really having an impact. And I mean, this is something that we'd want to try for sure. Because
definitely. I'm interested.
Exactly. I mean, just by having this conversation, this is absolutely incredible. We'll have it linked up so that everyone can find it and grab it themselves because this is key. Now, where can people find more information about you, either to keep learning about the information that you're putting out and how this is going to continue to move forward? Where can people go?
So thank you for that and really appreciate it. And people can find me on my personal website at drdave.io or apollo.clinic, which is my clinic website. And I am a practicing psychiatrist. You can also access any information about Apollo Neuroscience at apolloneuro.com or wearablehugs.com. We'll also take you to the same place. And you can reach me on socials at Dr. David Rabin on Instagram and Twitter. And I just want to, if you don't, can I make one comment on pain since you brought it up?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm also, you know, one of my main focus in psychiatry and neuroscience is addiction and trauma psychiatry, which is, you know, really working with these folks led us to develop this technology. Any doctor will tell you that working with patients is an incredible learning experience for us. And, you know, one of the things that we learned, especially during the pandemic, is that self-medication or binge watching Netflix, which is kind of like a self-medicating distraction, right? It's even though it doesn't require putting something into your body, you're putting something into your eyes and ears through the TV, is all about pain avoidance or discomfort avoidance, right? And so one of the things that we saw with the pandemic, which is what we see in any stressful situation in someone's life, whether you have a mental illness diagnosis or not, is that stress worsens pain. Emotional and physical pain work the same way in the body for the most part, and especially chronic pain. Stress worsens our perception of pain, increases inflammation, and increases discomfort. And when we don't have the training or the skill sets to manage that discomfort, we go to the thing that's the easiest way out, which is to avoid that discomfort. And that could be self-medication with prescription or recreational drugs or alcohol, or it could be binge watching Netflix or playing video games nonstop, right? It's not, or being a workaholic or being, you know, a sexaholic or a gambling addict or any of these things, right? They're all kind of the same related behavior, which is discomfort intolerance leads to discomfort avoidance, mm-hmm. right? And so what we're really trying to teach people is that you can retrain your body to tolerate discomfort in a healthy way, because discomfort is the challenge, it represents the challenges that are trying to force us to grow and become stronger, better human beings and better versions of ourselves. Mm. And so, you know, when you think about how touch works and why touch is so important, touch stimulates the release of all of the most important neurotransmitters and hormones in our bodies that we seek recreational drugs or video games or Netflix to induce, right? It's the oxytocin, the dopamine, the serotonin, the endorphins, the endocannabinoid molecules, the endogenous opioid molecules, and many, many more. The last three I mentioned, the opioids, the cannabinoids, and the endorphins are our natural endogenous, meaning coming from our bodies, pain-relieving molecules that we make ourselves. We have the ability to make our own pain-relieving molecules by learning to tolerate discomfort, right? So you think about how powerful that is and how none of us, for the most part, are taught that. And therefore, we wind up seeking drugs from the outside to supplement what we're not getting through gentle, soothing touch from our loved ones. That doesn't have to be sexual at all. It can just be, you know, holding hands, giving hugs, putting your hand on somebody's shoulder, right? Doing any of these things, even eye-to-eye contact like you and I are making right now, can induce the release of a lot of these same powerful soothing hormones. And so when we don't get that touch, we will seek those molecules from the outside to activate the same neurotransmitter systems that are getting deprived of their precious neurotransmitters and hormones that we should be making ourselves. So that's why soothing touch is so important. That's why learning about this kind of stuff is so important, and why technologies like Apollo that give a lot of the benefits of soothing touch to us and put the power to deliver soothing touch to ourselves in our own hands is so important, because it reminds us again that we're in control of a lot more than we think we are, and that we can start to self-regulate and restore self-control and empower ourselves to really be at the sort of in the driver's seat of our own lives as often as possible, which shifts the outlook on life to one that is actually very exciting and promising and rewarding, because we're at the center of it.
All the snaps, all the claps. This is everything.
That was probably the best way that you could, one, wrap up this first conversation, but two, plant the seeds for another hour and a half of conversation that we get to come back and have in the future, because you just touched on so many topics. I know you have a lot of expertise, and some of your primary work is in the areas of addiction and trauma, and we barely scraped on any of that today. Psychedelics, I know that you're doing a lot of work in psychedelics and how we can use that to start to crack into some of these drug-resistant or treatment-resistant disorders. Sleep, we barely touched on. Pain, you just mentioned here at the end. So many things that I know we are going to want to have you back in to talk into, and how we can start to take control with what you mentioned, the most powerful medicine cabinet and drug dealer that we have in the world, which sits right up here in between our ears, in our brain, and how we can start to tap into that a little bit more to release some of those endogenous drugs so we don't have to go seeking elsewhere. Just a wealth, an encyclopedia of information that you are able to dump out. And I know that we'd love to have you come back to talk more in the future.
Yeah, I would love to join you again. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So grateful for that interview with Dr. Rabin. Just all that he touched on with how healing touch, music, breath work, so many different things that can impact our level of stress. And if you're interested in checking out that Apollo Neuro, make sure you go down and check out the link in the show notes. Get it for yourself and see how you can actually start to make an impact with this passive device with your consistent levels of stress throughout the day. If you've been enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving a rating and review on your favorite podcasting platform, sharing this episode out with anybody who you think might benefit from it. And of course, we will see you next time on the Optimal Body Podcast.